With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, prepping for a new year and what that means for neonicotinoids. But our top story today, earlier this year, the House Agriculture Committee created the Bipartisan Agricultural Labor Working Group, with 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans working to identify and find solutions for the workforce issues faced by agricultural producers around the nation. California Congressman Doug LaMalfa is one of the Republicans on that work group. We spoke on the phone and he gave me an update. Here is that conversation.
Well, ag labor, as you know, we passed twice through the House a fairly bipartisan bill called the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which I was one of the members of my team very involved with in order to bring that to fruition. And it was a pretty good success. You know, we actually got a bill and got a lot of agreement from groups that don't normally get on so well. Passed it twice in the House, but it didn't get anywhere in that pesky other body, the Senate. So it's really a tough effort. So we have this working group this year so we've had several meetings, and I don't know, it's been all right, but I guess it's kind of culminated the other day's meeting was that we're trying to find all the pieces you can agree on unanimously or agree on, say, by a supermajority, and then things that we would agree on with just a bare minimum, you know, that are still somewhat bipartisan, and see what elements of that can be successful in a bill going forward. To me, I think if you start with the bills we passed, and then we have the reality of a Republican House is going to look at it a little differently, so that what tweaks do you need to apply to the bill before that could draw a good consensus of votes? Because, you know, we still have, obviously, the need for ag labor. One of the things our farmers talk to us most about, at least outside of the farm bill, and it really isn't a farm bill effort. It's a separate issue. And it probably should remain that so it doesn't complicate the farm bill and make it harder to pass. So, you know, it's going to be an ongoing conversation. And I guess I'll be hopeful on it. But we'll just have to see how, you know, the summary of this meeting the other day on finding agreement on the different elements at different levels of agreement, how that can ultimately, you know, form a decent bill. But I still think you have to look at the previous bill as a template of how we were successful in getting anything agreed on by diverse groups.
Was there anything specifically that really stood out to you that was a major issue with when it comes to ag labor?
Well, it's kind of a regional thing. Different regions want different things. And you know, some regions are looking for the ability to have greater variability in wages. Some are demanding more ability to have processors participate. For example, they want more processors to have the same type of labor. And hey, I'm for those conversations, but if they blow up the bill, the ability to pass a bill, then you aren't anywhere. So that's why in the previous bill, although we talked about having processor labor be part of it, we knew that was going to be kind of a deal killer. So, well, let's leave that one and we can come back to it at a different time. Let's get this vehicle, let's keep it moving. And, again, wage adjustments in certain regions of the country, being able to move wages back down when maybe conditions or prices get worse. I understand the ability to want to ask for that, but I don't know how you take wages away from people that are already at a particular level. I don't know how you go down anymore, especially with the Biden inflation that we have going here. How do you take back wages? You know, so that was kind of a sticker for a while in the last one. So, you know, but certainty is extremely important. Being able to have the H-2A program not be so burdensome just to get labor to come up here. You know, I've never thought the duty of the farmer to have to babysit and spoon feed labor just to get them to come do work. You know, I mean, they can find housing, they can do things, and, you know, they can be helpful on that, but having a farmer build all his own housing, it just seems, you know, I guess from a, not as a legislator, but as a regular layperson, I've just never understood why all that becomes a responsibility of the employer, like many other things. Like, you know, why is it up to the employer to provide health care to employees or provide health care plans? You know, employees, they can go figure it out on their own. You'll go through it through the union and stuff. So I just never see why the burden, like, hey, we're you know, I'm going to make widgets here. You want to come work for me? Like, yes, but now you have to take care of all of my personal issues. So I'm kind of going off the rails here a little bit, Sabrina, but it's just, you know, that's just a general feeling I have about the whole subject.
We continue with Congressman Doug LaMalfa right after this. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We continue now with Congressman Doug LaMalfa on the topic of the House Agriculture Committee's Ag Labor Working Group.
I was talking a few weeks back, or I guess it's been a month or two now, to somebody from Michigan with agriculture organizations in Michigan, and we were talking about the required labor wages for each state, and she was pointing out that when you add in all of the things that farm employers, you know, provide, have to provide or do provide, including housing and sometimes transportation and things like that, the amount of actual pay with all of that included that farm laborers are getting can really add up to be quite a bit more than any average worker in other industries. Is that something that you're seeing as well, or would you say that that would be fairly accurate?
For the employer, their cost, it reflects all those expenses. The employee might think, you know, they're making X amount per hour, but you can add probably 50% of that on top as what it costs the employer per hour. And that frequently doesn't seem to get knowledge or noticed, especially when the regulators are coming at you. For example, they passed a bill that that fast food employees are start getting $20 an hour, I think maybe January 1 this coming year. So what does that tell everybody else? Is that the minimum wage now has to be $20 an hour for everybody? Because if a hamburger flipper's getting that, then how can you get less for doing anything in an ag job or, you know, anything else, right? So that just moves the whole scale up in a way that doesn't leave it between the employer and the employee and the reality of what that marketplace looks like. So probably the net result is you end up with a lot more mechanization being, you know, looked for and pushed for.
You used a phrase there, the reality of the marketplace, and I think that actually speaks a lot when it comes to agriculture, when we're talking about the, you know, what our farmers are actually making for their product, which is different from other industries where, you know, if you make a product, like you said, if I'm making widgets, I can decide how much the widgets are going to cost. Here's what I'm going to charge for them. But farmers don't have that luxury. They don't get to choose what they're charging for their products, but yet they still have to take all of these costs in, including the rising labor, rising wage costs, and especially in California, the rising cost of various regulations. What kind of relief is there for our farmers?
That's very tough because, you know, if you quickly turn to cheap imports, and a lot of farmers in the West are, you know, doing more and more of their work in Mexico, for example, just to hold costs of everything down. And so we don't really have the luxury or ability to just farm it out to a different country or just cut costs. The things you can control maybe are trying to mechanize more or cut corners or what have you. And you run out of options pretty quick as a farmer. And so, heck, can you get a better price for your crop? Well, you know, when you got cheaper imports coming in undercutting you, that's why we need a much more vigorous aggressive negotiations by our trade representatives. And some might say, well, that's protectionism. Like, well, a domestically grown food supply is protectionism too, for the basic security of our country and our military. If we have to ask them to, you know, go engage in something we'd rather not have to do, but at least they got to be ready. So we need a stable food supply. So it's that has a pretty high value compared to what people actually pay for food in the country, you know.
Thank you once again to Congressman LaMalfa. Now here's Will Jordan with today's livestock report.
In today's livestock news, the National Milk Producers Federation emphatically commended the House of Representatives for taking a critical step toward improving child nutrition by recently approving the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act with an impressive 330-99 bipartisan margin. The measure, led by Representative G.T. Thompson, a Pennsylvania Republican, and Kim Schreier, a Democrat from Washington State, expands the tools schools can use to deliver vital nutrition to students by increasing the variety of healthful milk options schools can choose to serve. NMPF is delighted that the House approved the bipartisan Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act, said Jim Mulhern, president and CEO of National Milk Producers Federation. Milk's unique nutritional profile gives it an unparalleled role in providing kids the nutrients they need. Expanding the milk schools can choose to serve to include 2% and whole is a common-sense solution that will ensure kids have access to the same healthful milk options they drink at home. House passage is a critical step, and we urge the Senate to consider this bill immediately, so it may be enacted into law. Ghoul milk, a mainstay of lunch menus for generations, plays an especially important role in improving nutrition security as an effective, inexpensive way of providing the nutrition kids need. NMPF has been tireless in its advocacy for reinstating whole milk, which was removed from school lunch menus in 2012. Since then, advancing science on the benefits of milk at all fat levels, as well as evidence of increased food waste from current limited choices, makes its return a top nutrition priority for school children, the families who serve nutritious, fuller fat varieties at home, and the school meal professionals who strive to effectively nourish those whom they serve. The House-approved Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act will now be sent to the Senate, which already has its own version of the bill. The Senate measure is being led by Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas, Peter Welch of Vermont, and has Republican, Democrat, and Independent co-sponsored. In other livestock news from the American Sheep Industry Association, as part of the inaugural meeting of the White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience, President Biden and U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced recently that USDA is making investments that will strengthen American food and agricultural supply chains, expand markets for agricultural producers, and lower food costs. The announcement was made as part of the inaugural meeting of the new White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience, which is part of President Biden's agenda to lower costs for American families and increase investment in America's supply chains critical to economic and national security. Today's funding builds on prior investments made by USDA under President Biden's Investing in America agenda to increase competition and lower cost by enhancing independent meat and poultry and other diversified food processing capacities, strengthening local and regional food systems, and expanding domestic innovative fertilizer production. USDA is making investments in 185 projects worth nearly $196 million to create new and better market opportunities for producers and entrepreneurs. Among the projects funded are two with ties to the American sheep industry, $72,000 to a farm in New York, and $41,000 to Fiber Shed. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Australian experience with the Carpophilus truncatus should help with management strategies in California orchards. Cooperative Extension Specialist Houston Wilson said the beetle has been in Australia for about a decade.
They've been doing a lot of work to understand its phenology and its ecology and managing and all of that. So very quickly, we got in contact with our counterparts in Australia to talk about this beetle and what their experience had been with it. And the key to managing Carpophilus beetle is crop sanitation, which is good and bad. It's good because that's something we can do. We've already been hammering away at that. It's the key practice for management of naval orangeworm as well. So a lot of our communications around this, you know, it ultimately were saying things like, you know, if you needed any more reason to sanitize this year after the really bad infestation we saw of naval orangeworm and almonds, you know, here you go. You got to do this for Carpophilus beetle as well.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. A team of pest management and food safety researchers in the U.S. is conducting a survey to gather information on field equipment sanitation practices in agriculture. The study addresses broader concerns about transporting new pests, diseases, and pathogens on shared agricultural equipment. The researchers seek grower and industry input through a brief, voluntary survey. They aim to establish baseline information, understand concerns, practices, and barriers related to equipment sanitation across various U.S. crop sectors. The survey, conducted by a group of ag research and extension professionals, intends to guide future research and outreach efforts. Participation is anonymous, and the collected data will be used solely to shape research questions and outreach activities without publication or distribution. A link to the questionnaire can be found at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is reminding specialty crop growers about the Food Safety Certification for Specialty Crops program. The program offers assistance for eligible on-farm food safety program expenses. Producers have until January 31st to apply for aid on their calendar year 2023 expenses. The program aims to support local and regional food systems and assist small-scale producers in meeting food safety certification and regulatory requirements. Eligible specialty crop operations, particularly small businesses, can receive assistance for various costs related to food safety certification, including plan development, certification fees, microbiological testing, and training. Payments are calculated separately for each cost category, with higher rates for certain types of farmers. Interested producers can apply by submitting an application to any USDA service center. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network. Growers are encouraged to get well acquainted with DPR's new parameters for using neonicotinoids. President and CEO of the California Cotton Ginners and Growers Association, Roger Isom, said there's been some significant rule changes for neonics.
DPR has put some pretty healthy restrictions out there and in some cases just outright banned it. And on the cotton side, we're done. You're not going to be able to use neonics after the first bloom, and that pretty much is the entire season. So that product is done. For everything else, you know, it's going to be limited. You got to look at it product by product, commodity by commodity. It's just a pretty big restriction as they try to address what they consider is, you know, pollinator health and how neonics impact that. They put out some guidance documents by commodity, and I just encourage growers to take a look at those for their specific commodity and products that they might be using, you know, might not be able to or might have restrictions that make it not as effective or limit its usefulness.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network. UC Cooperative Extension will be hosting the SJC and Delta Field Crops meeting on Friday, January 12th. The meeting will begin at 8 a.m. at the Cabral Agricultural Center in Stockton. The meeting will open with an update on Delta rice pest management from Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor Michelle Leinfelder-Miles, who will also be presenting information on compost applications to alfalfa. There will be a regulatory update from the San Joaquin County Agricultural Commissioner's Office, followed by information on soil organic matter and field crops research and observations from the Sacramento Valley. Following the break, there will be presentations on Lima and Garbanzo breeding and dry bean heat stress testing, along with IPM issues with alfalfa weevil and aphids in alfalfa. More information on the meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
One Christmas tree grower in Virginia is urging more farmers, especially new farmers, to get into the Christmas tree business. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
It's rare that a farmer specializing in one crop recommends to others to grow the same crop in competition, but Virginia Christmas tree farmer Jim Gelson told me he's doing presentations to groups of farmers and would-be farmers, telling them,
look, forget about hemp. Plant Christmas trees. You don't have to get federal permits or anything. It's good to go. Get some acreage, plant some trees.
And he even has some numbers to prove his case.
You get trees for 20 cents a piece. Sorry, I'm going to put 5,000 Norway spruce out in the spring. That's $1,000. In 12 years, they'll be worth $1 million. What else can you invest in to get a return like that?
Wait a minute, though. That's 12 years with no income. How am I going to keep going without any income?
You got to believe in yourself, man.
Yeah, you laugh, but that's risky.
But it's calculated risk. So you've got an idea of where your return is, what your odds of return are.
Which he says is not true for hemp. Christmas trees, he says, are a solid commodity with a solid demand now.
Yeah, and I think the future looks good.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. As farmers are harvesting their crops, there are some challenges that may be flying under the radar they should keep in mind. Michael Clements has more.
Tom Fry, Director of Performance Products at the Mosaic Company, says it's important to think about the nutrients being removed with the crop.
I think one of the things, given the variability that we've seen in yields across fields, depending on water holding capacity, is trying to get their arms around how much nutrients have we removed from our various fields and cropping systems, and then figuring out a plan about how we're going to replace those.
Combating things such as lower nitrogen levels, Fry says, starts with soil testing.
It always starts with soil testing. They need to understand what their baseline is currently in their fields and then make a plan with their retailer on what's the best way to provide balanced crop nutrition.
Fry explains how farmers can increase their soil fertility this fall.
You know, MicroEssentials is a fantastic product that can really help growers manage phosphate and sulfur nutrition. But it's just one tool in the toolbox, and it takes soil tests to understand where are the deficiencies in their soils and how do they take into account both P and K as well as any secondary nutrients that they may need.
More information on nutrient removal rates and advanced crop nutrition is available online.
I'd encourage people to check out cropnutrition.com. It is a website with a wealth of information in which you can explore both crop removal rates based on actual yields from your farms, in addition to information on various products that can assist you in improving the efficiency of your fertilizer.
Again, visit cropnutrition.com to learn more. Michael Clements reporting.
Are you looking for some last-minute gift ideas for the lawn and garden enthusiast on your list? If so, this report from Gary Crawford may help.
On the second day of Christmas, my children said to me,
new cell phones and a big plasma color TV.
Oh, great, Scott. That reminds me, only a few shopping days left, and I still don't have the slightest idea what to get a couple of people on my list. However, if you know someone on your list who likes to garden, plants a lot of flowers and things, or just enjoys puttering about in the yard...
There are so many gifting opportunities available to you that have that personal touch that can help that gardener.
Dennis Patton is a Kansas State University Extension gardening expert, and he told us about several possible gift ideas for the yard and garden folks on our lists, and they are not new cell phones or TVs. First, gardening tools. Now, these are constantly wearing out, they're being lost, and they might need replacing with a little something better.
And what you're seeing more and more on the market are these that are designed with repetitive motion injury in mind, so more the ergonomic tools that have maybe bigger handles, softer handles, even some that maybe come up onto the arm that even strap on. So you're not just using that wrist motion, but you're using arm motion.
Well, that might be a godsend for a gardener. However, you may not be able to find these newer specialized tools at your local big box store.
You may have to go more to what I call a full service garden center, or maybe search out on the internet and set your computer in your jammies with your cup of cocoa and do your shopping.
I like that idea, but maybe your gardener friends need a different gift. If they are like me, my spade gets lost every season. The other gardening stuff is scattered all over the place. Now, Dennis Patton says you can buy some pretty elaborate kits and devices to organize gardening stuff, and that might be a good gift.
But a lot of times, just an inexpensive 5-gallon bucket works really great. Or I've also seen here again, going back to the hardware store to the construction side, they make these little caddies that fit right inside a 5-gallon bucket. And they have lots of nice pouches and pockets that you can put your pruners, your saw, all these equipments in. So when you go out to the garden, you just have to grab this bucket and everything you need is right there, ready to go.
Ah, yes. Other gifts might pale in comparison. Get it, pale. Okay, next, maybe you just need a couple of stocking stuffers for the gardeners on your list, and Dennis has you covered on that, too.
So what I think make great stocking stuffers are gift certificates to local garden centers, nurseries. So come planting season, you've got that mad money. You can run out and pick up a six-pack of pansies or a new tree or shrub for your landscape. And it's kind of a delayed Christmas gift, but it's always so helpful.
And if you don't like that idea...
Gloves, I think, are another great stocking stuffer. A nice lotion or oil after you get your hands in all that dirt. Sometimes they get dried and chapped, so some nice scented lotions are great.
And if you're not really into giving gardening-type gifts, I guess you could get them a new cell phone.
And a big plasma color TV.
On which they can watch the gardening channels, of course. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The December World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates show that China will cut back on soybean imports. Chad Smith has the story.
Mac Marshall, Vice President of Market Intelligence for the United Soybean Board, says the slowdown isn't a surprise.
Margins for hog producers have been really tough recently, continuing a trend that's existed over the last couple of years. So seeing that scale back in their expected importation of soy, I don't think is too surprising. It's still a tremendous volume, and that's really more what we should focus on, is trying to still continue to import those beans. We've certainly seen a lot of flash sales over the last couple of weeks. Clearly, there's an appetite in terms of Chinese demand for U.S. soy.
Marshall says the market pays a lot of attention to South American details in the December WASD.
Brazilian crop cut from 163 million metric tons to 161. Still a little bit higher than what most of the trade was expecting, which is closer to 160. You, of course, have local commentators down there that are reconciling both dryness in Mato Grosso as well as potential threat of soybean rust in some of the northern areas like Paraná. Putting all that together, there's an expectation of this crop maybe coming in less than what was initially expected. So it wouldn't surprise me if we saw additional cuts and subsequent releases that closely align with what local market commentators are saying.
There wasn't a lot of notable information from the U.S. numbers.
Turning to the U.S. side of the balance sheet, the crop is already made. We didn't have any updates to any volumes on the balance sheet. Really only notable thing was 4-cent decline in the market year average expected price for soybean oil. Not too surprising, I think, given the slide that we've seen in RIN values over the last couple weeks. Soybean oil is trading very closely to an energy, so you're seeing a lot more influence from the crude oil and overall energy markets influencing soybean oil. So we're seeing that down. That's balanced somewhat by a $10 per ton increase in expected price from the end.
Keep up with the latest news from the United Soybean Board at unitedsoybean.org and Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on RFD-TV. Chad Smith reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Here's Brian German with this featured interview.
We're joined by Joshua Ram this morning, Director of Technical and Regulatory Affairs for the California Walnut Board and Commission. And today we're talking about some opportunities for walnut growers to help get some support with climate smart ag practices, which have been more and more highlighted and popular in recent years. And so let's get right into it with what this new funding resource is.
Yeah, Brian, exactly right. And a couple things here with some challenges currently being faced. You know, the state already in the $31+ billion budget, coupling that with a $40 million shortage due to legislative errors for the CDFA's Healthy Soils Program, which is typically a staple program for the walnut industry. We've worked on securing funding and collaborative opportunities through another avenue that I strongly encourage all walnut growers take advantage of in order to help offset costs for their operations and some of these practices. This would be a Vibrant Future is the title of the project. It's a USDA Climate Smart Pilot Program working via industry partners. There's up to $15 million in funding available. A couple things on this project are, it's really the goal of these USDA Climate Smart Pilot Programs are to facilitate the implementation of climate smart production practices and to develop robust tools to measure inputs, outputs and yields and put in place systems for verification, traceability and marketing of climate smart commodities. Some practices that are available for growers to trial as part of this program are short season cover crops, nutrient management, residue and tillage management, alley cropping, water management, soil amendments and mulches. A couple expectations of the project participants for growers. Each grower is expected to participate in the program for 4 years and to commit to the implementation of one of the climate smart practices. As I mentioned, the growers will make implementation sites available or their orchards available to data and information collected no more than twice a year. For production suppliers, each supplier or vendor is expected to participate in the program for 4 years as well, and be willing to provide technical site-specific support throughout the process. There's a couple other benefits for participants that include assistance with the development of personalized plans for the implementation of climate smart practices, access to a certified crop advisor and sustainability consultants, subscription to a software data platform, and partial offset of direct costs involved in implementation of climate smart practices. Also of note are a modest cash incentive for participation, and data collected on the farm site is benchmarked against aggregated data. So this is a good potential opportunity for those farmers and growers out there looking for additional funding for their climate smart practices. Funding is up to $15 million. As I mentioned, the first group will consist of 20 growers, and it's first come, first serve. So be sure to get signed up as soon as you can. And there will be a second group with a longer list of participants eligible here in the future. Those dates will be coming out soon. Can apply now, and there'll be a link that'll be shared. And if you have any further questions, feel free to contact myself at jrahm@walnuts.org.
And now, you noted as part of participating in the program, there's an expectation of reporting some of that data that's recorded there. And I would assume, just because of concerns regarding data and privacy, this information will be aggregated in some fashion and kept private for individual growers, right?
Absolutely. You yourself will have access as the grower to your data. However, any other data there is aggregated and anonymized, so there won't be any issues with confidentiality. It will be secured and confidential.
It's holiday mealtime, and to help with making sure you've got the perfect main course, here's Susan Littlefield.
With the holiday upon us, so is the time for picking that perfect roast. If you're not doing prime rib, maybe you're thinking something else, but it can be a bit overwhelming when you head to that meat counter. But have no fear, because Chef Gavin Pinto with Certified Angus Beef is going to walk us through the process.
So the first thing to look for in quality is just ample marbling. So, you know, look for the Certified Angus Beef logo. You know you're going to get a quality cut of beef with plenty of marbling. And the second thing that you want to consider is the group you're feeding. What are their favorite steaks? You know, because if you think about a roast is just a larger version of a steak. The steaks are cut from what would be a roast. So if everybody in your family loves ribeyes, prime rib is probably your answer. If some people maybe don't like the ribeye, some people find it a little fatty, some people do like it. You know, some people like that robust flavor, some people want a little leaner. A New York strip roast is a great answer, especially if you're a New York strip eater. It's a great in-between, between a tenderloin and a rib roast. It still eats like a rib roast. You can cook it very similar, but it's a little bit leaner while still having nice marbling. And then if everybody's just, you know, they're nuts over fillets, then a tenderloin roast is the way to go. But, you know, finding a roast with really beautiful marbling is going to be key for flavor and tenderness.
Kind of know what people want. What are we thinking size-wise?
So there's two things to consider. One, if it's boneless, I usually suggest about half a pound per person. If you want leftovers, maybe 3/4. And it depends on, you know, how much people eat. But I think half a pound per person is pretty standard for a boneless roast. Now, if it's bone in, like a prime rib, I would go closer to a pound per person because you do gain weight with that bone. And the bone is great. That's something that you can cut off and, you know, use to make stock or snacks. Some people just love to eat those rib bones after they come off the prime rib. But either way, boneless or bone in, you can't go wrong. It'll just vary in the quantity that you're purchasing.
I wanted to kind of rewind as you talked about the marbling or the fat content. You obviously want to have that because fat equals flavor.
Right. And a lot of people think, they see all that white fat on the top of a roast. They think, oh, it's fatty. Well, that's what you probably are. That's kind of renders, right? That cooks down. It kind of bastes the roast from the top down. And that's something you can cut away when you eat it if you're not a fan of that. But that those little flecks of fat within the meat, that's the marbling, and that's what's going to add the flavor and tenderness. And it kind of bastes the roast from the inside out. So, you know, some of that will render out, but that's what's going to keep it tender and juicy and delicious.
So some people think they have to rotate the roast, shall we say, while it's cooking. Is that something you recommend, or is that more just a prime rib type of move?
I would recommend rotating your roast 180 degrees, just because it does tend to be a little warmer in the rear of the oven as opposed to the door. But I would do that about halfway through and try and only open the door to the oven that one time, if at all possible. It'll just keep the heating more consistent and even. And if you're like me and you love to have, like, keep an eye on things, I have both a leave-in probe thermometer that's got a metal cord, Or you can buy like the meter type thermometer that's wireless, and it'll still tell you the internal temp. That way you don't have to open the oven to check on your roast.
And what do you suggest when it comes to seasoning, now that you've got that perfect roast picked out?
So seasoning, you can go anywhere from your basic salt, pepper, garlic. And I suggest granulated garlic as opposed to fresh or dried, because those tend to burn. Whereas the granulated is a little bit smaller and it creates a crust on the roast.
And that's some great advice to go pick out that perfect roast. And that's Chef Gavin Pinto with Certified Angus Beef. I'm Susan Littlefield.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. And now for more news, Farm Service Agency Direct loan customers now have the ability to apply for financing and check on their loans online. Rod Bain reports.
It's a new way for existing and new USDA Farm Service Agency direct loan borrowers to have easier access to loan applications and connected financial tools, as they can now
submit that loan application online.
Deputy Agriculture Secretary Sochel Torres-Small says additional offerings through the FSA online loan application include
some additional interactive guided support, as well as use their electronic signature option to submit that loan application online. And they can do that from their computer, from a tablet, or from their cell phone.
This is the latest in a series of efforts by FSA to streamline the loan application process.
First, simplifying the direct loan paper application, taking it down from 29 pages to 13 pages, which is shorter than a lot of commercial loan products.
Farmers' feedback on what was most challenging about applying for a loan focused on not understanding the right kind of financial product to apply for.
So we developed a loan assistance tool to provide customers with an interactive online step-by-step guide that helps identify the direct loan product that might be the best fit for their business needs.
The loan assistance tool is available at farmers.gov. Now, some things to note regarding who is currently able to use FSA's online loan application. First,
they'll be instructed to set up an e-authentication account in order to keep all of that important financial information secure. And they'll go to farmers.gov/account for that. That'll allow them to apply for a loan. Farmers, too, want to get an update on where their application is in the process. Are they approved yet? So another part of this is the ability to track your application online through a personalized portal.
Also,
right now the tool's available to individual farmers, but if you're a married couple applying jointly or a legal entity, FSA is hard at work to make this opportunity available for you starting in 2024.
Access for existing and new online loan applicants is available at
farmers.gov/loan-assistance-tool.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
America's family farmers got some good news last week from the U.S. Treasury Department. Chad Smith has more on the announcement regarding sustainable aviation fuel.
The Biden administration is adopting the GREET model for the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Tax Credit. Betty Resnick, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, talked about the guidance.
The Department of Treasury issued guidance adopting an updated GREET model for tax credits for the sustainable aviation fuel, which were established in the Inflation Reduction Act. Producers of sustainable aviation fuel are eligible for a tax credit between $1.25 and $1.75 per gallon if the fuel reduces greenhouse gas emissions by at least 50% as compared to traditional jet fuel.
Resnick says the GREET model helps measure the emissions impacts of fuel.
The GREET model is a tool built by the Department of Energy to measure the carbon intensity, or kind of the greenhouse gas life cycle impacts of fuel. And it stands for the Greenhouse Gases Regulated Emissions and Energy Use and Transportation Model.
She says the adoption of the model will unlock a new market for certain crops.
So the adoption of the GREET model opens the door to the use of crop-based feedstock such as soy and canola oil and corn ethanol to be used in sustainable aviation fuel. Aviation fuel is about a 36 billion gallon industry, and that has the potential to be grown by America's farmers. And it's another example of agricultural's role in a climate smart future.
For more information on the announcement, go to fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvardson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.